Good morning. Welcome to the International and National Security Law Practice Group of the Federalist Society's National Security Symposium. It's an event we've been delighted to do for a number of years. And before I turn it over to the moderator for our first panel, I should introduce myself. My name is Matthew Hyman. I chair the practice group. And I want to offer some thank yous. First, I want to thank the Federalist Society, and in particular, Nate Kaczmarek and Jack Capizzi, who were instrumental in organizing the logistics of today's event. I also want to thank the National Security Institute at George Mason University, who is a co-sponsor of this event. And I also want to thank the Jones Day Law Firm, who is hosting us today in this lovely setting. I welcome all of you who are here in person, and I'm also appreciative of all those that may be watching us via live stream. As you'll see from today's agenda, it is very much focused on the U.S. role in the world. The first panel will focus on regional strategies and conflicts. The second panel will take a step back and talk more about what should U.S. grand strategy be, regardless of region. Our moderator for today's first panel is a former colleague and a longtime friend, Jamil Jaffer. Jamil's bio is about as long as my arm.
I can't keep a job.
I'm sorry?
I can't keep a job.
Well, he's had many jobs. But the short summary is Jamil is the executive director and founder of the National Security Institute at George Mason University. He's also a venture partner with the Paladin Capital Group. Before that, Jamil's had a number of roles in both the private sector and the public sector, serving in the White House. He had a stint in the Department of Justice. He was a clerk for Justice, and then before that, Judge Gorsuch. And he also served with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, among many other things. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Jamil and let him introduce the panel.
Awesome. Well, thank you all for being here. Matthew, thank you for that kind introduction. I'll introduce the panel, and then we'll jump right into questions. And we'll have a significant amount of time towards the end of our conversation for audience questions. So please do be thinking of questions along the way, and we'll just get right into it. So to my immediate left, but perhaps not to my left in real life, is Michael Allen. Michael currently serves as the Managing Director of Beacon Global Strategies, a leading D.C.-based strategic consulting firm, which he's helped lead since its founding. From 2011 to 2013, Michael served as the majority staff director of the House Intelligence Committee, where he was my boss and tried to fire me. And he helped enact three consecutive intelligence authorization bills, as well as key cybersecurity legislation. He served in a variety of roles in government as well, including in the Bush administration for all 8 years, where he was a special assistant to the president running counterproliferation and legislative strategy. Immediately to Michael's, he's also the author, by the way, of Blinking Red, Crisis and Compromise in American Intelligence After 9/11, has a JD from University of Alabama, cum laude, a BA from Vanderbilt University, and an LLM with distinction in international law from Georgetown University Law Center. So thanks for being here, Michael.
Thank you.
To Michael's left, Mark Dubowitz. And this is almost certainly not in ideological order by any stretch of the imagination, but maybe, who knows. Mark is the CEO of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, a D.C.-based Nonpartisan Policy Institute, where he leads projects on Iran, sanctions, countering threat finance, and nonproliferation. Mark won't admit it, but he is one of the architects of the Iran sanctions regime that has been so successful over the many years. He's one of the key financial warriors against Iran, as the Wall Street Journal has said. And he's testified more than nearly two dozen times before Congress and foreign legislatures. Prior to that, he was a venture capitalist and a technology executive. He has a master's degree in international public policy from SAIS at Johns Hopkins and law and MBA degrees from the University of Toronto. He's the co-author of over 20 studies on economic sanctions and Iran's nuclear program. So, Mark, thanks for being here. And then last but certainly not least, Professor Julian Ku, a longtime member and leader in the Federalist Society. Professor Ku is today the Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs and Faculty Director of International Programs and the Maurice Dean Distinguished Professor of Con Law at the Maurice Dean School of Law at Hofstra University. Professor Ku's primary research interest is the relationship between international law and constitutional law. He's conducted academic research on a wide range of topics. He's the co-author with Professor John Yu, another key Federal Society member, of Taming Globalization, International Law, the U.S. Constitution, and the New World Order, published in 2012. He's published nearly four dozen law review articles, book chapters, and symposia essays, and has co-founded the leading con law blog, Opinio Iuris, which is read daily by thousands worldwide. Before joining the Hofstra Law faculty, Professor Koo served as a law clerk, Jerry Smith, at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit, right down the hall from where I clerked for Judge Edith Jones. He's an Olin Fellow in lecturer in law at UVA, and he's also a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School. Don't hold that against him. So, Julian, thanks for being here as well. So, if it's all right with everybody, I'm going to just jump right into questions. We're not going to do opening statements because who needs those? So, Michael, I'll start with you. The world is literally on fire. Conflicts in Europe, the Middle East, the potential for major conflict in the Indo-Pacific on the verge. Never mind a half dozen coups in Africa. The list goes on. I want to start by discussing the ongoing war in Ukraine, though. Talk to us. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, please.
Thank you so much for having us, and Matt and the Federalist Society. I really appreciate it. I'm from Alabama. I talk slow, so Jamil and I will balance each other out.
There you go. I am sprinting through my questions because you want to hear from them. You don't want to hear from me.
So
Ukraine,
right.
is happening. The war is ongoing. We're supporting them at some level. Given everything else that's going on in Ukraine,
yeah.
Is it time to just cut the funding and drop, let it go? There's a lot of other things going on. We got potential problems in the Indo-Pacific. We got problems with our friends in Israel and Hamas terrorists. Maybe it's time to just wind this thing up, let the Russians have it, and off we go.
So
what do you think?
I'm glad that we're starting at first principles on Ukraine. The president, even if it's Biden, who I don't support and don't think he's particularly convincing in his speeches, should have been giving many more addresses to the nation to talk about what the strategic interest is of the United States in Ukraine.
Is there one?
Yes, I'm getting to it. There is a vital national interest for us there. One, let me just remind you that Russia is an adversary and was one before they reinvaded Ukraine in 2022. I carry around a list just for moments like this. They invaded their neighbors in 2008 and in 2014. They attempt coups of NATO allies. They interfere in U.S. politics. They've destabilized the Middle East, cheated on arms control agreements, used chemical weapons against dissidents, and sponsored cyber attacks against the United States and our NATO allies. And then they invade Ukraine. And let me tell you why it's in our interest. First, it keeps the war from spreading westward. World wars begin in Europe, and we need to help Ukraine finish the job or at least prevent them from moving and threatening NATO. It would be much more expensive over time if we had to be sending numerous divisions to Eastern Europe to prevent prevent the Russians from moving westward. So that's one big thing that this is in how it's enabling the U.S. national interest. It's also degrading Russian capability and giving time to our European allies to get their act together and meet their Wales commitments at NATO, which is to spend upwards of 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. And it's otherwise helping them stand up the defense industrial base and other things that we are going to need to continue to keep a lid on this revanchist Russia who wants to move and threaten the United States with China and upset the Western balance of power in the world, if you will, that has allowed the growth of our economy and fuels the domination of the United States across the globe. Finally, if you care about Asia, and I do, we have to win in Ukraine. One, think about the investment of U.S. prestige in Europe. People in Asia, the fence sitters in particular, are studying what we're doing in Ukraine. And if we back off and say, never mind, we'll be there next time for you, our credibility will plummet. These fence sitters will strike their own deals with the Chinese regime. And we will be, over the long term, not only displaced as the world superpower, the guarantor of trade lanes across the globe, the United States economy will suffer in the medium term and will lead to the eventual degradation of a Western-dominated world. The world is at stake. It begins with Ukraine. We as Republicans need to stand up for this particular strength of the United States in helping and winning in Europe, because it's going to help us win in Asia and in the Middle East.
Well, so you left on the table my favorite argument, which is the vast majority of money we're spending in Ukraine is actually being spent here in the United States on American jobs, on American weapons. Yes, the weapons are going to Ukraine, but they're American jobs that we're paying for. We're not sending buckets of cash, like we have, by the way, to Iran, to Ukraine. We're actually spending that money here. But I do want to come back to this question of why the Europeans shouldn't pay for this and why we're paying for it. But we'll come back to that. I want to ask Mark a sort of a related question, though. So, Mark, a lot of people made the same argument about our support for Israel, right? Like, look, this war has been going on for 2,000 years, right? This didn't begin on October 7th. It didn't begin when Israel was founded. It really began, 2,000 years ago. This war is never going to end. Why should we keep pouring more money and more weapons into this fight? Let the Israelis figure it out. Let them figure out Hamas. This isn't a problem for us. They're not trying to kill us here in the United States. We're protected by two oceans, right? Let them, or as some have said, let Allah figure that one out, right? We don't need to worry about this problem. Not our problem. We got bigger problems in Asia. We can't do the Middle East and Asia at the same time. Let's pivot.
Right. So first of all, thank you. Federalist Society, gold standard for turning ideas into action. So we all at Washington think tanks aspire to be like the Federalist Society. So great to be here. And great to be with all of our panelists here. Look, I mean, I think there is a model out there that, we've kind of learned the hard way in the United States after Iraq and Afghanistan, which is that we need to find allies that are willing to fight and die in their own defense. We actually have two allies right now who are doing exactly that. One, as Michael said, in Ukraine, right? The Ukrainians have fought incredibly bravely against the Russian military. And we haven't provided them with the weapons, the long-range weapon systems they need to take the fight into Russia, which is where we need to go. The Israelis, since 1948, have been fighting and dying in their own defense. And there is a value in Israel. It's almost sacrosanct that Israelis will fight and die, and they don't want American soldiers to do so for them. Right? I mean, that is the ethos of the country. An 18-year-old men and women are drafted into the military. They go in and they become officers. And many of my friends serve. Their kids are serving, and this is an incredibly brave and patriotic generation of young people. And I know Michael, you were just in Israel, and I'm sure you saw that, right? This was the sort of TikTok generation. All my friends thought these kids were spoiled and they were not going to willing to fight. And after October 7th, they got up, and now they're in Gaza. They're in Lebanon, and they're fighting in their own defense. So for the United States, I mean, two allies that literally have not asked for one American soldier to risk their lives are asking for the weapon systems that they need to defend themselves. And in the Israeli case, as in the Ukrainian case, most of the money gets spent in the United States on American jobs. So it seems to me to be a model that we want to replicate around the world, right? We need to do this with the Taiwanese. I was in Taiwan last year. It was a pretty depressing trip because I came away thinking, I don't think the Taiwanese are ready to fight and die in their own defense. Yeah. Right? And I think that's partly our fault in not helping train the Taiwanese or let the Taiwanese realize that at the end of the day, we will be there for them, we will have their back, but they've got to take the front. So this to me seems to be a model that we need to replicate around the world. Instead, we're doing the opposite, Jamil. I mean, actually, we're sending a message right now that we are no worse friend, no better enemy.
The opposite of the message that we've historically sent.
Well, the opposite of the Marine motto, right? No better friend, no worse enemy. Our message around the world, if the Democratic Party to Israel, is we're going to cut you off. Right? We're going to tie your hands, and then we're going to cut off funding. And I hate to say it, on the Republican side with Ukraine, there are members of the Republican Party and leading thinkers in the Republican Party who want to do the same thing to the Ukrainians. So I think
presidential candidate, maybe even.
And even a presidential candidate. So there seems to be this kind of bipartisan consensus that it's a good idea to abandon your allies, even when they're willing to fight and die in their own defense. And all they're asking for is for the American in defense industrial base to kick in the high gear and be able to defend them so we don't have to risk our men and women.
Well, so Julian, a lot of this turns on this question of whether we can fight a conflict or be prepared to fight a conflict in the Indo-Pacific. against China if they decide to go across the straits into Taiwan, and whether we can do Ukraine and do Israel and fight a conflict in Taiwan if it comes to that. And there's a lot of folks, a lot of conservative leading thinkers who say we can't. And so, one, the president's been unclear about our policy on Taiwan, President Biden. He has gone on national television four times and said what I think a lot of us believe, which is that the United States will defend Taiwan with troops. Of course, every time he does that, 5 minutes later, Jake Sullivan, his national security advisor, goes to the podium in the White House and says, well, what the president really meant was we'll send weapons like we're doing in Taiwan, like we're doing in Israel, we won't send American troops. And so it's not clear what our policy in Taiwan is. They claim it's we want to have strategic ambiguity. That helps. I'm not sure it helps. But one, what should our view on Taiwan be? Should we be prepared to defend Taiwan with American troops? And either way, whether we're defending with troops or sending weapons, can we really walk and chew gum at the same time? Can we send weapons to Ukraine and give them what they need to win the war against Russia? Can we help Israel win its fight against Hamas and deal with a third contingency with or without American troops in Taiwan?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Jamira, and thanks. I'm really psyched to be on the panel with such experts in this. I think that this is the question of the day. I guess I'll start with saying that I think what makes the Taiwan, or really the China issue, different is that I think what's new about the way we need to think about this is that it's not like, oh, there's Europe, and there's the Middle East, and then there's Asia, and they're kind of the same similar significance. And it's not true anymore. The Asia is substantially more significant economically and strategically than it was in the past. And I think for at least 15 years, or since the Obama administration, the U.S. government has been trying to pivot or rebalance its resources toward Asia, because I think it's recognized that this is where the largest economy, economies in the world are. This is where the growth in the future is going to come from. It's not going to be coming from Europe. It's not going to come from Ukraine. And Russia is declining, right? In the Middle East, Israel is in a lot of trouble, but it's also still stronger relative to its potential enemies. The only country that has a serious threat to the long-term position of the United States is China. And so I think it's not unreasonable to say we need to redirect and rethink and refocus. And as someone who's followed Asia issues a long time and very interested in D.C. and elsewhere, it's always, we need to think more about Asia, and then, but oh no, Europe. Or Israel. And it's not that I don't think Israel and Europe is important. It's just that Taiwan, Asia, China always is like the third thing, because I think most of us think first because of our history and our connections to Europe. I think that's what I think is going on. The bigger debate here is that China is the only country that has a real chance to displace the United States. I don't think Hamas is going to displace the United States. I don't think Iran's going to displace the United States. I don't think Russia's going to displace the United States. There is one country that can. It's called China. Has the economic power, technological power, and military power to do all those things, which is much stronger than the Soviet Union was in many ways. So I think it's not unreasonable to think we need to think differently and focus more seriously on Asia. Is there a one-to-one trade-off? Does that mean we have to rush and just cut off the Ukrainians and say goodbye to Israel? No, I don't think so. But I do think that we always say we need to care more. The Defense Department's official policy is China is the focus, but it never really is. Because then we always get distracted by something else. Ukraine is really important. Israel, really important. We'll get around to Asia, hopefully it'll be okay. So I guess I'm a realist on this now. So my view is the reason why we have our policy on Taiwan is because we need to play for time.
Okay.
We're not in a position right now to, we don't have the capacity, and that's not really, it's not really a trade-off with Ukraine and Israel. It's just that the United States does not have the capacity right now on its own to guarantee and deter a Chinese invasion of Taiwan. That's just a reality we have to face. So we need to, now China's not gonna win, we'll both lose. Mm-hmm. But there's at least we don't have the same dominance we had in the 1990s, both economically and militarily. So that's what the problem is. And so for the United States, I think in the ideal world, we would say, look, Taiwan's off limits, right? If you go there, we'll defend it. There is a strategic interest that's very important there. What I'm worried about is the capacity of the United States.
Okay.
And I don't think we have the capacity given the size and scale of China, which again, it's not even in the same ballpark as Iran and Russia. It's kind of like thinking about, it's like Iran and Russia are really dangerous, terrible enemies, and maybe they're meaner and more cruel, but China's the only one that actually is the full scale one we can, and so that's why I think, with Taiwan, I'll just say the last thing of your question is that I don't mind Biden. Look, the Chinese think we would defend Taiwan. but with military troops. I think
they do think that. Okay.
Their military plans for that. They assume there will be U.S. intervention. So their strategy is to not just say, oh, let's talk them out of it. What they'll do is they'll try to deny the United States military from getting access to it, which they can do now with their missiles to essentially make it a no-go zone for U.S. aircraft carriers. And they can bomb Guam, et cetera, et cetera. So they have a lot. So they're planning for, they're not assuming the United States will not get involved. What they're planning for is defeating the United States in the military conflict. So it's not enough to say, we will defend Taiwan, and the Chinese will, okay, well, then we'll hands off.
Yeah.
It's no longer, where we could say that 20 years ago. Today, it's, we'll defend Taiwan, the Chinese will go, yeah, okay, I don't think you can really do it. I think we can beat you. They can actually think that now for the first time. And so I think that's why we have to focus. I don't think we're in a position to make that kind of, we need to be careful and nuanced because we need time. In the long run, I do believe the United States will prevail. But in the short run, it's a very dangerous time, and we need to play for time and not provoke a fight over Taiwan.
So it sounds like, and I want to make sure I have this right, Julian, it sounds like you're actually where the Biden administration is, which is being nuanced on Taiwan and ease away from our conflicts in Europe and the Middle East and pivot towards Asia. Where do you disagree with the Biden administration's current policy on these three efforts?
Oh, no.
That's provocative.
Okay. Oh, no.
It might be mean, because I actually am worried that he's going to say...
Well, all right. So I would say this. Right. I mean, actually, I think the Biden-Trump administration on China has been relatively straightforward. On Taiwan, ironically, Biden has been more explicit than President Trump ever was, and frankly, President Bush ever was on defending Taiwan, although he muddied it, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
I think that's actually right. Right. He is actually, I think in his bones, he really does feel instinctively that actually Taiwan is something worth sending troops over. He may not feel that way about the country. Anyway, so I guess I'm not, I don't think the Biden administration has everything right. I don't think, and I think that there are things but I would say in the broad picture, focusing on China is the right thing to do. And I think that this is actually something the Trump administration said it wanted to do too. I think the execution is really the hard part, right? You don't want to just say, well, but we're just going to pull out of Ukraine and give up on Israel. That's not possible. It's not politically possible. I don't think they're trying to do that either. But they need to figure out a way to execute in a way that actually helps preserve the long-term position of the United States. So yeah, maybe, I guess, all things being equal, their position is probably better than the alternatives. It's not what I would like to have. I would like to have a clear defense commitment for Taiwan, but I think I'm a realist now, and I'm getting old, I guess. And I just don't think we have that. I don't think we have that capacity in the United States anymore to really bear down and scare the Chinese off of it.
So I know Mark wants to jump in, then I'll go to Michael. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. I actually agree with this. Absolutely, China is the major enemy. I think Russia and Iran are significant enemies. I mean, the Iranians are on the cusp of nuclear weapons. When they have nuclear-tipped ICBMs, there's only one address for those ICBMs, and that's the United States of America. So the Islamic Republic is a significant strategic threat to the U.S. And our allies in the Middle East, not just Israel, by the way. We've been talking about Israel, but we have other important Gulf allies and others we need to defend. I think this whole debate actually sometimes misses the detail. And actually, my colleague Brad Bowman, who runs our military center, did an exhaustive study on this. I wish Brad was here because he'd do a better job of explaining it. But he went weapon system by weapon system. Throughout the sort of entire kind of inventory, what he pointed out is, you know, here are the weapon systems you need for Ukraine, and here are the weapon systems you need for Israel and Iran, and here are the weapon systems you need for Taiwan and China, and here's where they intersect. And so it's mostly a land war, Russia Ukraine, right? It's land and aerial with respect to Iran. And it's mostly kind of naval and aerial with respect to Taiwan, right? You don't need, tank shells and howitzers to defend Taiwan. So it was a very kind of detailed and nuanced look at what these choices are. And I think, you know, Julian's right. I mean, we have to make kind of nuanced, detailed choices. But kind of this conceptual debate that we have here in Washington, it's either China or it's Ukraine or is in Israel. I don't think we need to actually choose. What we need to do is look at the specific weapon systems, look at our defense industrial base. And Roger Wicker, Senator Wicker, who's the ranking member of Senate Armed Services Committee, had a great op-ed today in the New York Times, and he's putting out a huge report on what the defense industrial base needs to look like. And he says, I mean, we need to go to 5% of GDP within a certain period of time. I mean, I think that's right. And we're at historically low levels adjusted for inflation. But let's be more nuanced about this. I mean, let's look at specifically on the defense industrial base, because I believe we can defend. I think we can act in all through three theaters. The problem we have is the size of the U.S. military and where we're going to send our brave men and women to fight. And this gets back to my original point. The Ukrainians are not asking for American soldiers, and the Israelis are not asking for American soldiers. The Taiwanese are. And maybe that's where we need to direct them.
So, Michael, and Julian, I see you want to jump in. But, Michael, let me ask you a question. So Mark has made the argument that we can do all three at the same time, and because of different systems, and if we spend more money, we can do it. The question is whether we can afford to do it. But I have a separate question for you. Are these really three different fights? Or are we really talking about one enemy that's really working together? We know the Chinese and Russians have announced this no limits partnership. We know that Russia and Iran Iran is sending drones to Russia to fight in Ukraine, and Russians are sending American weaponry that they capture to Iran to learn and train on it. And North Korea has long gotten weapons capabilities from nuclear weapons capabilities from the Pakistanis, through the Chinese, through the Iranians, right? That there's a long-standing collaboration between these four American adversaries. Is this really a different fight when we're talking about Ukraine and Russia from China and Taiwan? Or is the same fight just a different theater?
So they're very interrelated. You mentioned the Russia-China alliance. That is growing exponentially since the war in Ukraine in 2022 began. First, basically, China's bailing out Russia. They're buying all their oil. All the oil and their gas, so that, unfortunately, our sanctions have not worked as well as they could have. And the Russian coffers have been refilled with Chinese money. Second, of course, you look at a simple missile attack into Ukraine and you look at the guts of the missile. It's guidance systems from China. The missile could be from North Korea and nearby drones that have crashed or from Iran. So you have significant cooperation there.
I mean, Iranian military officers on the ground in Ukraine supporting the Russians.
And a factory. But these are just like examples and details. The larger picture is that, as people are beginning to call it, this is an axis of upheaval. President Bush, our boss, called it the axis of evil. Different countries. But this is now something that we need to seriously, seriously study. They are working more closely together. They are rejecting a U.S.-led international order. They want to supplant the United States as the world's leader, and they want to be able to advance their own values, which are antithetical to those of the United States,
but
capitalism, trade, everything that we hold dear, these guys are working against us on.
Yeah, but maybe that's okay. Right? Maybe we don't really care about that. Why does that matter? Why does it matter if they supplant us? Right? Look, we can't be the world's policeman. We can't afford to. We've got enough problems at home. We've got the southern borders a bloodbath. The American people are suffering under the current economic policies that we have. Right? We've got plenty of problems at home. Why do we need to worry about how we're perceived overseas and whether we're defending our allies or fearful to our adversaries? Well, who cares?
So you want to talk about a real America first type argument. America, let's just be honest, is the good guy in the world. We're the ones that are leading the fight, that are enabling economic growth through trade and free trade in general.
Maybe we should stop. Who cares?
Well, then over time, China, which as everyone has described accurately, certainly has the power to supplant the United States, becomes the world dominant power. They start with invading Taiwan. They more or less take over Asia. And over time, they grow outward.
But they'll never invade us, so who cares?
Well, it's not about that. It's not only about if our country is invaded. It is about our way of life, the economic system that we have created since World War II that has led to American prosperity. If you want to get down to brass tacks, like what are we doing with grand strategy and national security?
Yeah.
And the rest, it's about creating American prosperity. So Americans can have jobs. Hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of U.S. jobs are dependent upon Asia. And if we lose Asia to China and then allow it to continue to expand our way of life, our economic dominance, and the democratic systems of the West will slowly but surely be eclipsed, and it will be an entirely different, dark world.
All right, so Julian, Michael's made the argument about why China matters, right? But he's also made the argument about why the China fight, and the fight that you said is the most important and decisive one for the future of American national security, is no different than the fight with Russia and Ukraine, is no different than the fight with Israel and Hamas, because these adversaries are all cooperating, Iran with Russia, Iran with North Korea, China with Russia. This is all one big effort against us, and we may not be coordinated, but they are.
Hold on. I didn't say no difference.
I'm putting words in your
different.
Mouth.
They're different. I think it's no different. We have to have a sequencing strategy. One fight is on us now, and the other one maybe we have a few years. Ukraine has woken us up. We'll build the defense industrial base to get more ready for China in 2027, 2028.
I don't think it has. But
I think it
so,
has.
All right. So let me, yeah. So I did, there was one thing that I just, to be clear, what I think is the biggest difference between what I think and maybe what the Biden administration policy is. The Biden administration is not even calling for an increase in defense budgets. Right? They're not even asking
for calling for a net reduction.
Right. And so, you know, I think any credible strategy is going to, on any spectrum, whether you China first or whatever, there needs to be a serious increase in U.S. commitment to its military defense. And all the talk about defense industrial base as well. And I think, like, the fact that the Chinese can build tons of naval ships and we can't. Like, they can build 20, we can build one, right? It's just not, so that's a problem. And I think that's a huge difference, and that's why, that's also reflects why I'm a little worried about our current capacity. I think if we were in a world where the U.S. was serious about committing to its military defense by putting money into it rather than just making statements, then I'd feel a little more comfortable. Now, I would just say, the way I'm thinking about this, and I think, I was just joking, no one studies history anymore, at least in colleges. History majors is a dying, no one's studying history anymore, or very few. But I think we all need to become Cold War historians again, like, because I think we are in Cold War II, basically. But the difference is that in the Cold War I, Soviet Union was priority, rightly so, and Asia was kind of secondary theater. I think we have the mirror image reverse. So in Korea, we didn't fight all the way to the end to liberate North Korea. Maybe we should have, but we didn't. We cut a deal. We cut our losses because the bigger, more important fight was in Europe. Mm-hmm. I think we have the reverse image of that here. So it's not about abandoning Ukraine, but it's also about recognizing that if it is one struggle, right, you might have to make a deal with Ukraine that's unsatisfactory, right? Maybe just like we did in Korea, in order to preserve the resources and focus you need in the more bigger threat. So I think that, I'm not saying you have to give up on everything just to pick one, but I do think you're gonna have to make trade-offs just like we did in Cold War I. We didn't have a world in Cold War I where we won every battle. In fact, we lost a lot of them. We only won in the end.
So what about that, Michael? I mean, Julian's making the argument I think the President Trump has made, which is that on day one, he's going to come into office, and he's going to end the war in Ukraine, which essentially means he's going to give a certain amount of territory to the Russians and starve Ukraine of weapons to fight for that territory, right? Doesn't that seem like a pretty good deal, right? So, the Russians already have that territory. They're not going to give it up. Ukraine today, with what we're giving them, isn't able to take it back. We'd have to triple down to get that territory back. The Obama administration already gave up Crimea, so why not give up a little bit of eastern Ukraine and just get the war over with, save the money, spend the money on the Taiwan fight, and off we go.
But also, if you added, so he plays Eisenhower, right? And then bring Ukraine into NATO as the deal, right? That would be the way to do it.
Donald Trump's going to bring Ukraine into NATO, right?
Well,
I'm not holding my breath for that.
Well, but maybe, right?
Right.
I don't think Trump is just going to walk in the door and truly end the war in 24 hours.
He says he will.
He says he will. He also has an interest in not being seen as a pushover. His entire identity is about strength. I think the unwritten story of how we got the $40 billion or $60 billion supplemental spending done is that there were dozens of people who went down to Mar-a-Lago over time and said to President Trump, you're not going to be able to achieve what you want to achieve when you're president if Ukraine has just been trampled. You need to set the conditions for peace. You need to allow this funding to go through. Ultimately, Trump understood that. Maybe it was at a personal level or what he wanted to accomplish or at a political level. Maybe it wasn't grand strategy and the things we're talking about here. But I think Trump has an interest in ensuring that he is not a total pushover when it comes to Russia, and he may try and enable Ukraine so that he can get a better deal. By the way, the Ukrainians, they may be ready by the time January 20th rolls around, but I was over there in October. None of them are ready to compromise. None of them are interested in a ceasefire. They firmly believe that they would be passing along a war to their children and their grandchildren. If there is a ceasefire under President Trump in his first year in office, it will be temporary. And you may have a series of these over a decade. But Putin is in this for the long term. He is going to grind or attempt to grind Ukraine down over many, many years. He has a plan to take all of the territory, the left bank of the Dnipro. He wants to continue to try and pressure NATO and otherwise have a veto of security decisions in Europe. So while Trump may think he's going to end the war in 24 hours, I think we're in for a much larger and longer struggle, and that Trump will begin to appreciate this more when he's in office.
Well, and Mark, I want to ask you, because I think there's a relationship between what we might do in Ukraine and what we might do with Hamas and Israel. But I do want to remind the audience that we will be coming to you for questions here in the next 15 or 20 minutes or so. So please do have some questions ready. So Mark, should we take Trump at his claim that he's going to end the war in 24 hours or a year or whatever it is? But ultimately, the end will be not a Ukraine win, right, which I think is what Michael was advocating for, which is give them what they need to win, but rather some amount of concessions to Russia. And if so, what does that say about what our policy is or should be with respect to Israel and Hamas? Should we try and, as the Biden administration is, get a deal done now that involves, you know, the recognition of a Palestinian state with God knows what government, right, over Gaza, right, a exchange of hostages, well, you know, exchange of a lot more Palestinian prisoners for Israeli hostages and American hostages, by the way, let's not forget that, and just end that conflict too. That way we have these two things off the table, right, and we can go deal with Taiwan and China.
Well, first of all, I mean, Israel's fight is not just with Hamas. I mean, that is sort of the near-term priority because of October 7th. The fight is with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Ali Khamenei has the exact same strategy with respect to Israel that Vladimir Putin has with respect to Ukraine, which I think Michael did a great job of explaining Putin's strategy. Khamenei is fighting Israel on seven fronts. Okay,
The United States, to be
clear. Well, and the United States, clearly. There's a ring of fire around the Israelis. They're fighting the proxies of the Islamic Republic. On April 13th, the Iranians fired 321 cruise and ballistic missiles and drones at Israel for the first time, first direct attack from Iranian soil. And Khamenei wants to turn Tel Aviv into Kyiv. I mean, it's sort of the same strategy that Putin has, which grind them down, war of attrition, right? Inflict severe damage on it, drive out, you know, the best, the brightest, and the most flexible, leave behind kind of a rump that is outgunned, outmanned, and no longer has U.S. support, and then move in for the final kill shot. I mean, that's
the same position, by the way, of a lot of college students on American campuses today.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. I mean, Khamenei was actually just tweeted out today praising U.S. college students for standing with his righteous cause. But at the end of the day, I mean, this fight against the Islamic Republic is a fight that the Israelis are going to fight, I think, on their own. I mean, I think what we need to do, again, is provide them with the weapon system so they can engage in this fight. But we also can't be pressuring them to cease fires, to stop fighting, to allow Hamas to reconstitute itself. Hamas has committed to itself October 7th over and over again. Don't forget the northern border right now, where there is a war going on with Hezbollah. Right? It's an intense war. It gets no coverage in the United States. But there are 60,000 Israelis who moved out of their homes in the north. There's Hezbollah with over 150,000 missiles, including precision-guided munitions, that they will use to inflict massive damage, overwhelm Israel's air defense systems. And again, this is part of Khamenei's strategy. So, you know, if what we're suggesting is let the Ukrainians bleed and lose, and then give...
Which is, by the way, ultimately... In any way, in any place where we concede Eastern Ukraine in any Trump deal, right? That's a loss.
It's a loss, and I mean, if we think Putin will stop, and that'll be it with Putin.
Well, we thought he'd stop at Crimea.
Well, exactly. So we think he'll stop. Okay, maybe there's an argument, but do we really think Vladimir Putin's going to stop with just some territorial concessions in Eastern Ukraine as he's thrown his entire you know, Russian military at this fight? I don't think so. I was just in London last week. The Brits don't think so. The Europeans don't think so.
They won't pay for the fight.
Well, I think increasingly they're realizing they're going to pay for the fight, and they're willing to pay for the fight, and they have to pay for the fight. And look, we need to get our allies not only willing to pay, but willing to fight. And again, this is to my point over and over again. I mean, only the Ukrainians and the Israelis have demonstrated a willingness to fight. I mean, I care less about weapon systems than I do about America's boys and girls, right? I'm much more concerned about sending them over to fight in all of these wars. What I am, and this is why I prioritize, find me an ally willing to fight and die in their own defense. And then we, the United States, need to do everything we can within our means to defend that ally. And so show me other allies around the world willing to fight like this. I mean, the Kurds are willing to fight like this.
Well, let's talk about that, though, because, Julie, I want to ask you this. You mentioned, multiple people mentioned the Taiwanese are not ready to fight for their own country, and maybe that's a reason to not send American troops to defend them, right? At the same time, where we have had American allies willing to fight and fight for their own territory, the Afghans lost 60,000 of their people when we lost 3,000. The Kurds won the war with ISIS for us, and yet under President Biden, we abandoned Afghanistan in an embarrassing way. Under President Trump, we abandoned the Kurds in an embarrassing way. Why should our allies want to fight for us? Look at Ukraine, look at Israel. They fight on their own behalf. They fight our adversaries, right? And we announce publicly from the podium, we're going to cut you off from weapons in Israel. With Ukraine, the Republicans in Congress say, we're going to cut you off from weapons, right? If you are allies, why would you ever trust the Americans? And if you're the Taiwanese, why isn't being reticent to fight in your own defense the right answer for them?
Okay, so it's a rough world out there. And just to be honest, there aren't that many other options for the Taiwanese, the Israelis, or the Ukrainians right now. So,
concede.
Yeah.
In other words, they
fight because of their own interests, not because America's supporting them. In other words, the Israelis are fighting not because America's supporting them with weapons. They're fighting because they believe in what they believe. The Ukrainians are fighting because of what they believe in, right? It's not about us.
They want to survive.
Yes, they want
to
survive.
They don't want to die.
Right.
And they don't want their kids dying.
I think that's what it comes down to. The Taiwanese are moving closer to that position. I think the difference with Taiwan is that for many years, the identity in Taiwan was mixed, and there was a much more complicated political sort of warfare within Taiwan over whether they really wanted to be separate from China. I think Taiwan's moving closer to the consensus of we just don't ever want to be back with China, right? But that took a long way to get there, and it's a more complicated history, and so then the Taiwanese sense of identity is just different. It's much more in flux and less developed than I think in Israel, certainly in Israel, which was born out of a victory in a war, I guess, right? I mean, in the 1948 war, Taiwan, they're the losers of the war. And there's not a lot of optimism about Taiwan in the first place. They just kind of ended up there. And so there's no heroic victories of the army in Taiwan of anything, of any kind, in their entire history. My father served in the army in Taiwan, like when he was, it's the worst army ever, he says. They'll like fold in 4 minutes, right? Now, that was 60 years ago, so hopefully they've improved. So I think it's a more complicated situation. Look, I guess my bigger picture here is the Cold War, I think, is going to be giving lessons. In the long run, we're going to win. We should win. We're the good guys, I agree. And we're in a better position. We have a very strong economy, we have the dynamic, we have all the features, so we need to figure out a way to get there, right, to get to the long run, but the short run is very ugly, right? And so I'm not advocating abandoning, I'm just advocating we gotta
pivoting.
Recognize there are trade-offs. There are real trade-offs.
Sequencing.
Because here's one example of the trade-off. One of the best ways to support Taiwan and stabilize Asia is to build alliances in Southeast Asia, right, so that there's a bit of a united front against China, like Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines.
But
right?
Doesn't that require people to trust us?
Guess what they do. What? Well,
yeah. Do they trust us?
They do. We have deep military
should
alliances.
They?
Maybe they shouldn't, but they do. But
so
look,
I disagree. They don't trust us.
Yeah.
I mean, I have to tell you, as you travel around the Middle East, around Asia, around Europe these days, there is a complete lack of faith in American leadership and American resolve. They think President of the United States, whether Biden or Trump, is going to abandon them. And so they're going to make choices on that basis, right? I mean, if we keep telling our allies to stay away from China, which is what we're doing like in the Middle East right now with the Saudis,
right.
Okay? And we're saying stay away from China for all these reasons. And if you don't, you know, here are the consequences. That's fine. But you also have to say to them, you know what? you have another choice. You have America, and we're credible, and we're serious, and we are willing to use instruments of national power, not just in your defense, but in our own defense. But they don't trust that. I mean, it's amazing around the world. There's like a consensus view around the world. You cannot rely on America's leadership. And as I said, we are today we're no worse friend, no better enemy. And that is the perception.
So I'm going to come to the audience for questions right now. But Julian and Michael, I want you both to weigh in on this. Do you think our allies trust us around the globe? And should they trust us?
Well, look, the levels of trust are lower than they were. Although the positive image of the United States is higher around the world than it has been in many years. In other words, if you take surveys of public opinion, the public opinion view of the United States.
Yeah, because we're not viewed as mean anymore. We're viewed as nice and huggable, but not really defending our allies.
Defending our allies is one thing. I think most countries don't want to fight in the first place, right? So what they want is a positive vision of a world that they would like to live in. And that's what the other thing was missing. We're not offering. It's not just a question of, are we going to support you in a war? But if we don't have a war, what kind of world is led by America? Is that going to be a world we want to live in? And I think that's the other problem. We're building up our economic barriers. We're moving toward cutting off trade. We're not offering a positive economic vision. There's actually a big problem in Asia. The Chinese are offering a more positive economic vision. So I think it can't just be about
fake
military
ones.
Alliances and deterrence. It's a much bigger story. Just like the Cold War was mostly not about military alliances, military agreements, military guarantees, and trust. It was also about building interrelationships, economic interrelationships, and soft power. All those things are part of it, too. I think we focus too much on military alliances, especially in Asia. It's got to be part of a bigger strategy. And that's why I think the Cold War is the right analogy for us.
Michael?
Well, by the way, I agree. I mean, the Biden administration, Trump wasn't much better, but this is going to be the first presidency in decades to not have any free trade agreement whatsoever, especially in Asia, when we're at a moment, just as Julian pointed out, where we need to offer something. You know, maybe TPP wasn't the right formula. Maybe Obama rolled it out poorly, whatever. But we need some alternative offer for Asia to lock them in more with the United States. Economically is the way to go. It's what drives the world. And that's obviously a place where we need to be able to get our politics back into some degree of normalcy, as they say, so that we could eventually have this thing to offer. Back on your question, is the United States reliable? I mean, I think it's an open question right now. Thank God we came through with the Ukrainian supplemental funding. I think that was a very difficult battle. It is indicative of a U.S. political system that is grappling with isolationism.
A Republican Party in particular, conservative movement.
And I wrote something for the Wall Street Journal on that I'd urge you to take a look at. It sort of analyzes the vote and tries to understand where the U.S. Congress is going here. But we have a series of decisions over time that we need to make good on. If Trump is elected, I think he needs to not sell Europe down the river. I think he's got to step up in a larger way in Taiwan. By the way, you know, just to build on what Julian and Mark have said, I don't think people really believe that Donald Trump is going to support Taiwan in a fight with China. He's fond of saying, when people bring him Taiwan issues, especially when he was in the Oval Office, he would say, this table is China, and the tip of this pen is Taiwan. That's his way of saying, don't let the tail wag the dog. So we have enormous questions coming at us today and in the coming months where we need both presidents to be able to stand up in a more forthright way. Just on the Middle East, I don't think the president has a realistic view of what's going on over there. Israel feels embattled. Their security situation has changed since October 7th and since Iran abandoned its proxy-only strategy and hit them directly. They believe that their deterrence doesn't work anymore. They're going to be more active in trying to defeat their enemies. And while Biden runs around trying to condition assistance and talk about doing more ceasefires, I think all of that is falling flat, and it's reminding people in the region and elsewhere that we're either unrealistic or unreliable or both.
Yeah, I want you to say something about the politics of the supplemental, and Michael knows far more about this than I do. But when I was in London last week, and these European foreign ministers and defense ministers, to some extent, bashing the Israelis. I try to remind our European friends that that supplemental passed because Speaker Johnson and others understood that if you tie Israel aid to Ukraine aid, you have a better chance of getting Republicans to support it, right? I mean, I think there's sort of three wings of the Republican Party today, kind of the isolationists, the China firsters, and those of us who, you know, sort of believe in American national power.
Party's a smaller part of the Republican Party.
Correct. And I think the party is divided on many, many questions, obviously including Ukraine. But interesting, all three wings of the party actually support Israel and admire the grit and determination of the Israelis who are fighting an American enemy. I think because of that, the Speaker and others were able to leverage that unity within the Republican Party on Israel aid in order to get Ukraine aid passed. So I'm reminding our European friends, the more time you spend bashing the Israelis, the more you undermine the case for Ukraine support. And they're not quite seeing that obvious connection. We need to reinforce that.
Well, I said I would come to the audience for questions, and we've got lots of time left. I've got lots more questions, so let's go to the audience and see if you all have any questions. Yes, ma'am, in the front. And there's a microphone coming your way. Oh, there's a microphone up here. I think we'll bring it over to you in just 1 second. There you go. Not sure it's on.
Thanks very much for that very interesting panel. So I'm going to address this question to Professor Koo. I read an interesting article recently with the provocative title, "Winners Sometimes Quit and Quitters Sometimes Win." And it was...
Wow, sounds like the Biden theory.
Well, it was speaking about Ukraine, harking back to Vietnam, which I notice has not been discussed here today. And I will say about Ukraine... All right, let me just stick with my train of thought, or if you ever want to get to the next question. You know, in Vietnam, we heard exactly the same line that Mr. Allen is putting out today. Gotta stay in there, gotta draw the line here. If we don't win in Vietnam, you know, Russia takes over everything. So what ultimately happened, we withdrew, put together some sort of, you know, peace with honor, essentially lost that battle. The world realized that it really wasn't in our strategic interest, and we won the Cold War anyway. Now, Mr. Koo, it sounds like you're endorsing that same approach for Ukraine so that we can pivot to Asia. So here's my question, which is about Asia. In Taiwan, it's obvious Taiwan, defending Taiwan, is very much in our strategic interest now because that's where all the semiconductors come from. If it wasn't where all the semiconductors come from, I have to wonder if Taiwan is such a big deal or isn't some chess piece that shouldn't also be given back to China. The real priority, it seems to me, is getting the onshoring and moving out and diversifying that key industry out of Taiwan.
Thanks. I think there, I mean, I'm not saying that, I just want to be clear, I'm not an abandoned Ukraine person, not at least. What I'm saying is that the Cold War leaves a lesson, though, that it can't be, and I think the cost for us in Ukraine, for the United States, is very low compared to the cost of the United States in Vietnam, right? Or Korea. The cost of the United States in Vietnam and Korea were massive, right? And so, obviously, the trade-off there is much worse. So what I'm saying, though, is that what worries about Ukraine is a maximalist position, which is that if you give up 1 inch of Ukrainian territory in the settlement, it's all over and we'll never be able to achieve our credibility back. I think it's going to be somewhere in between where we're just giving up, which I don't advocate, and demanding we go all the way back to 1991. I think it's got to be somewhere in between. We have to be at least open to the possibility that just like with Vietnam, and also South Korea it's terrible what happened to North Korea, but South Korea is a pretty terrific place, right? If Ukraine 60 years from now looks like South Korea, I mean, some people don't like South Korea, but come on, K-pop, you know, come on, right? Korean food, ever. There's some value there that it doesn't have to be a total disaster. It might not be the best result, though. So, all right, so now with respect to Taiwan, I think you're right. But I would say Taiwan even before it accidentally became the semiconductor capital of the world, it was still a strategic interest, as frankly, as a way to focus and keep China from focusing on the rest of the world, frankly, right? And it will continue to serve that function as a way to balance China. And frankly, China has a lot of capacity to do other terrible, they're kind of getting there now, but Taiwan, I think, as long as it remains independent, separate, it really will suck up a lot of China's focus and energy, regardless of whether or not there's a semiconductor thing there. But I do agree with you, the problem for Taiwan then is right now we have more will to defend Taiwan, but not, in my view, not enough capacity, both on the Taiwanese part and the American part. But in the future, I think the problem will be most Americans are still not really sure where Taiwan is, right? And so that why would we want to fight over it? I mean, if you told them no more iPhones, no more iPads, then I think even the TikTok generation would go fight for that. But having said that, I think we do have some, there is going to be some future where we have to think about the Chinese are always going to care more about Taiwan than any American will. And so we have to figure out a way to make that balance work where our capacity is strong enough to make up for our relative lack of will with respect or interest in Taiwan. I don't think that day is here yet. And I think there's other values that Taiwan can really bring to the table as a strategic balancing point for China and Asia. So I think it is worth, for the near term and even for me, the long-term future, I think it's still worth the U.S. investment.
And so even though I know there's additional questions and the question is directed to Professor Koo, since Michael, since you were called out for being Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger all in one, some of that might be a compliment, some of that might not be. Is your position on Ukraine essentially the Vietnam position? If you let this domino fall, all their dominoes will fall in sequence. And when that wasn't proven true, aren't you wrong here also?
Well, one, obviously this is not like Vietnam. There are no U.S. troops in Ukraine. And as Mark put in a different context, the entire thrust of what we're doing, and going back to the beginning of my remarks, is to empower the Ukrainians to fight and wear down Russia so that Russia doesn't become a threat to the United States by way of overrunning Ukraine and threatening NATO, where we do have a U.S. interest and commitment.
Obligation.
Obligation. Because we, in our wisdom, post-World War II, after watching two catastrophic events, decided we cannot have another world war, and we cannot have one in particular in Europe in the same ways that we always have.
Well, can I just ask about that real quick?
It's not that I think all of Europe is going to collapse, but we would have to send troops to Poland and the Baltics in enormous numbers and spend even more than we're spending in Ukraine if Russia continued to roll westward and threatened NATO.
But President Trump has an answer to that. And his answer is, look, if the Europeans aren't willing to put up their money to support NATO and to meet their commitments, their 2% of GDP,
yeah,
we're out. And so we don't have a defense commitment anymore. Let Russia take Poland. Who cares?
President Trump should and will take some credit for what will happen here in July. We will have the 75th anniversary of NATO. And there will be dramatic announcements about, I think it's 19 new states have finally met their 2% of GDP commitments in NATO to spend in their own defense. And there will be enormous new commitments made to Ukraine from other European allies. I agree with President Trump. I agree with what President Bush said and others, which is that everyone ought to step up. But if President Trump wants to create a two-tiered system of, hey, the Article 5 commitment only applies to those that have met their GDP obligations, I think that's a bad way to go. It sounds, from a populist standpoint, terrific. Yeah, if you hadn't paid your bills, we're not going to help you out. We need to urge them to pay their bills and hurry them along. But it is exactly what Putin wants us to do, which is to create a two-tiered NATO system and cause great confusion about who we're defending and who we're not, because of who's paid their bills, and more importantly, it will break down into a fight over what expenditures have you made and the rest, and is that toward military in Ukraine? So we can begin to answer a lot of what President Trump is doing. He put more emphasis on it, and Europe finally, just big picture, after all these years of NATO is brain dead, and what's NATO's point anymore, we have a threat convergence, finally. for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that is that Russia is still a threat to the security of the world, especially in Europe. We're beginning to see things more clearly. They have a worse defense industrial base than we do. Shocking. I do believe that the Ukraine war, in service of what we need to do in Taiwan in order to build up deterrence and what we need to do for our own sake in the Middle East and Europe, it's an alarm clock in the middle of the night that said, you guys better hurry up and rebuild your defense industrial base because the defense of the free world is at stake.
Okay, ma'am here in the front, and I see a gentleman in the back, so right here.
Thank you.
I think it's working. It's working. Yes. Yeah, so do you think he doesn't know, or that he knows and is trying to achieve exactly that goal?
This is a big debate among all of my clients. I'm briefing what the Trump administration is going to look like. And one of the things—
You should tell all of us, because—
Our business is like reducing uncertainty. I can't tell you anything with certainty, absolute certainty. It's like, that's what the CIA says. Go ahead.
Putin. And yes. Probably the most experienced and capable fighting force at the end of all this across all of Europe and maybe across the globe.
Gotcha. Okay. I can. One on what Trump says, I agree. He has said some things that are totally irresponsible. What I'm about to say is not a great rubric on how to judge people, but let's see what he actually does. And he hasn't repeated it since. I think, and part of the themes of when I try to discern for clients, what are they going to do? I think most often Trump wants a deal. He cares about himself. He cares about his personal advancement and his Nobel Peace Prize aspirations, which I always hear about. He wants leverage. That's what he's doing when he says the things he's saying. I don't think it's possible, by the way, here's to answer your second question. Ukraine has a vote. I don't think he can impose something on the Ukrainians, especially not in 24 hours. The Ukrainians, I think, will say, well...
But if he's going to pull all the... If he says, look, I'm cutting off supplies starting tomorrow, obviously there's some remaining amount of supplies, but that's not going to last a long time.
Well, Europe hopefully will be coming more and more online. Our stuff will at least go through a year from now, if not, you know, right around January 20th. I think he's going to do a Ukraine review once he gets into office, if he wins, and that's what we need to worry about. I think that's all I had on.
Okay.
Do you feel, in your opinion, do you feel he thinks he's in a position of strength or in weakness?
All right. So first, what does winning in Ukraine look like? Is it all the eastern part of Ukraine? Is it taking Crimea back? Is it none of those? And I'll go down the row, and then Julian, you can also end on what you think of Xi.
So Julian said earlier, well, the United States needs to be able to contemplate or accept an outcome where Ukraine gets back not all of its territory. You know, I agree. I don't think that I've written an article that says we ought to support them to get Crimea back. I take your point that a lot of these areas, you may not have national security safety for Ukraine if the Russians have Crimea. But I think that over time, the Ukrainian people may have to accept a frozen conflict so that they need to end the war in order to rebuild their defense industrial base of their country. I think just realistically, we're all talking about realists, these things may happen in the coming years if Ukraine is absolutely exhausted, even if the United States is still supplying assistance and aid to them. I'm not for it. I want them to be able to push the Russians out of their territory. And to have a situation where Russia can't threaten Ukraine.
So you're willing to support
over. I think we need a realistic policy in the Middle East, Asia, and Ukraine, where the United States is the world's leader and we are supplying intelligence, missiles, armaments, training, so that other countries will fight on their own against U.S. enemies.
Okay,
so
but that I'm going to pin you down on this because it feels like you're trying to have your cake and eat it too.
Okay.
On one hand, you want to say, I support Ukraine taking back all of its territory, but we need a realistic policy.
It may not happen.
Okay, so what if you were president for a day, king for a day, whatever, right? What's the deal you would accept? What deal would you encourage the Ukrainians to accept, short of which you would cut off
U.S.? I would listen to what the Ukrainians want to do about
that. They want to take it all. They want it all back, too.
So I would support, assuming I was president for 8 years and had a pliable Congress, I would try to make the case that for the United States to be able to hold its own, remain the global superpower, that we should support Ukraine in its efforts to take back its territory.
Does that mean, like Mark had said earlier, and I want Mark's view on this, that you would give them the weaponry they need to hit Russia inside of Russia?
Of course. How embarrassing that the Social Democratic Party in Germany is to the right of Joe Biden on attack.
To the right of a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate, including Josh Hawley.
Yeah, that's insane, too.
And J.D. Vance.
That's insane, too. But just as a general, we know our own party's problems.
Do we?
Yeah, I think we know them all too well. It's painful. But how embarrassing that the Germans are to the right of Joe Biden on whether the Ukrainians ought to be able to use ATACMS and other missile systems to hit massing Russian forces just over the border into Russia before they strike Ukraine.
Mark?
All right, so my theory of victory is, as Americans, that territory is important, and assessing these conflicts and end states is important. But the most important thing is to do severe damage to the enemies of America. So the way I see these conflicts is we have allies willing to fight and defend their country so that their country can be free and so that they can survive. But we also have allies who are willing to inflict severe damage on the enemies of America. So I think we should give them the weapon systems they need to kill as many Russian, Iranian, and Chinese troops as possible, in order to defend our interests. And with respect to territories, there's a lot to be discussed in all three conflicts. But what is absolutely clear is we have to weaken those enemies. And I know this is a consistent theme in my remarks, but I'd rather that foreign troops are the ones on the front lines inflicting damage against America's enemies rather than American troops. So that's how I would assess Ukraine. Let's give them the weapon systems to kill as many Russian soldiers as possible and do severe damage to the Russian military. Let's give the Israeli the weapon systems they need to do severe damage to Iran's, not only military, but stop its the Iranian nuclear weapons program, which again, we're a turn of a screw from the Islamic Republic having nuclear weapons. And again, when it comes to Taiwan, I love the Taiwanese. I mean, seriously, Taiwanese democracy is something to behold. It really is. But it's 8 months of conscription. Okay, the Taiwanese youngsters will complain to you that they don't want to go into the military because they have these nonsense jobs that they don't really do anything. Their reserve duty is a joke because they don't really serve. They come every 4 years. I mean, Israeli reserve duty is essentially you go in, you're conscripted for 3 years as a man, 2 years as a woman. You stay in reserve duty into your 40s and now into your 50s. And you fight in the same unit for 30, 40 years. Now, that's like Band of Brothers stuff, right? I mean, that's the kind of model that you need in Taiwan. So again, from Taiwanese, they're going to need our help to do serious damage to the Chinese Communist Party. But we need to get the Taiwanese to help themselves so that they're capable of inflicting that kind of damage. And then we may face the choice of having to send American soldiers there in defense of what I think is a critical interest, not because of semiconductors only, but because we know where things are going to go in Asia if we lose. The Japanese, the Filipinos, the Thais, the South Koreans, everybody's going to move into the Chinese camp out of fear and self-interest.
So, Julian, you have two questions directed at you. End state for Ukraine and President Xi, where are you at on his view of the world?
Oh, okay. So end state for Ukraine, not being a Ukraine expert, but I guess the theme of my remarks is that, look, I would like, and I actually don't have a problem with supporting Ukraine with military aid, like the way we're doing, and I was a big supporter. We should probably do more, right? Because it's relatively low cost, like the arguments we've made, compared to what we did in Korea, Vietnam, or the other Cold War lessons we have. So this is a much better model for us, much more
sustainable. Not putting American troops on the line.
Right. I mean, maybe that would, it doesn't seem like that's what we need to do right now, and we can go pretty far with support. But I do think, though, in the long run, I think, and this goes against my hat as an international lawyer. As an international lawyer, the answer is, you know, internationally recognized borders. That's the answer. Crimea, all the way back, Eastern Donbass, it all comes back. The problem with that position is that, although that, I think, legally is defensible, it seems, I think if we stick to that, we might end up overcommitting ourselves. So I think...
In a lot of other places, you mean.
Right, and here as well. So I think that's a problem to... So that's why I think the more, from a more realist standpoint, the better answer is to secure Ukraine. The territory doesn't matter as much as security, right? It obviously matters. But if there's a secure Ukraine, that's why I keep thinking of whatever the equivalent of, and it's very expensive to maintain South Korea, but whatever the equivalent defensible border, you bring Ukraine into NATO in a secure sort of fashion where Ukraine
NATO. So you would bring Ukraine into NATO?
Yeah, I think you bring Ukraine into NATO. The trade is, you bring Ukraine to NATO, but maybe you live without getting all of your borders back immediately, right? We have a frozen conflict. That's security matters as much as territory. I think as this war goes on, it's going to matter even more. So that's just my take on it. But I'm not an expert in Ukraine.
This is going to come across the wrong way, but I'm just going to say it because it's in my head. That sounds sort of like the Neville Chamberlain position, right? Which is, whoa, territory doesn't matter. Security matters. We'll secure them when necessary. And by the way, that got us.
Well, that's not fair, because actually what Julian is saying, and Julian, just to think through the implications of what you're saying, Ukraine goes into NATO. We now have an Article 5 obligation to defend Ukraine against Russia. So you're actually like, you're not Neville Chamberlain, you're Winston Churchill.
Right.
I mean, actually going to the right of us in terms of hawkishness.
Right. I mean, I think NATO can be very valuable in that sense.
If we actually uphold our commitment in that scenario.
Right. So that's a hard one, right? So it would probably have to be some version of a NATO partnered security treaty of the kind of weak ones we have now. But there's got to be some version of this.
They're already in Partnership for Peace. They're already part of that.
No. I mean, like, we're talking about, like, aren't they talking about some defense commitment to Saudi Arabia that will never go to the Senate somehow? Like, there's a lot of weird things going on in the world that don't seem to go.
So give them a commitment that's meaningless?
No, but it's something that's a little less formal than the NATO system.
Which is how it'll be seen by the Russians. Then they'll test it.
Well, I think
that... And then we'll whiff.
I think there's a way to get... the Russians will also eventually get exhausted, and that's why things like the settlement over Korea held for 75 years, right? So, look, with respect to... So I'll just... Look, I think that I think in the long run, again, I still say this, I think long run we'll win. In long run, the Russians get tired. In long run, maybe the Ukrainians get back everything. But I don't think it's a short run thing. It's not going to happen with we send in the right weapons. But maybe okay. I'm wrong. Maybe all I'm right. not a Ukrainian. All right, now quickly on Xi Jinping.
Oh, yeah, sorry, yes, sorry.
All right, so if I knew what Xi Jinping thinks.
You'd make a lot more money than being a professor in Austria.
Yes, I would, right. You know, I was just reading this book that recently came out on Xi Jinping Thought that was really well done by some scholars in the UK. It's really, look, it's a mystery. I think the concern for him is that we don't know what kind of information he's getting. The American diplomats say the only way they can be sure is when they get a face-to-face meeting and they tell him directly because they have no idea if he's being told anything else. So it's more than a black box. It's but having said all that, I think he actually is the first Chinese leader to have lived in the United States.
Yeah. Right?
He actually has thought about the United States probably more directly than most Chinese leaders have had. And I think historically, he does not think much of the United States. He was one of those people who came to America, saw it, and said, boy, this place is terrible. It's going to fall apart. And I'm not impressed. And so and I think his general viewpoint is that long-term decline in the United States. So I think, and I don't think he's got a lot. And I think he thinks it's a combination of things, the political system, he thinks, which we haven't done well in showing him the opposite for 2 years. And he thinks that there's a long-term decline. Now, what he hasn't thought about enough, I think, is the long-term decline of China, which mm-hmm. I think is a real problem. And he's not getting good information on his own country falling apart in many different dimensions. And I think that's why we'll win in the end. Yeah. But he doesn't realize that.
All right, sir, here in the front.
Yes, Cliff Webster, president of Black Watch International, also part of the defense industrial base. 30 years helping out defend the country in a different way. Two questions, one to Professor Ku and one to Mr. Allen. It's a different type of war, in my opinion, and tell me, the question to you is, am I right or am I way off base? It's a different type of war that we will be fighting against China. We've been talking about people on the ground, arms, the cyber. I've watched 30 years of China's increasing cyber capabilities. Mm. I believe that will be a more significant component that we'll have to defend against. Tell me if you agree or disagree. I'd love to hear your thoughts there. And then also, you know, to Mr. Allen or anybody else, you know, is the middle leadership, maybe not the president, but is the middle leadership significantly aware of the requirements to defend ourselves? Because if we are attacked in a cyber manner, indirectly lives can be lost as well. Maybe not through bullets, but you know, can affect our troops and our intelligence. And in our even our economy. So your thoughts on the cyber side of the war.
So just very quickly on cyber, I agree that you know, this is where it's a great asymmetry problem where we're more vulnerable to cyber attacks than they are because of the nature of their system. And so it's a great area. The Chinese know this, the North Koreans know this too. And so they've invested a lot more in cyber attacks than we have, and I think that's a real vulnerability. I think it goes to the bigger picture, which is I think the threat from China is not just the troops and the missiles, but it's actually it's cyber, it's space assets. It's also, I think, and this is one thing I wanted to raise, and this is where it's going to get hard for Americans, it's political influence. The Chinese have a reasonably effective political influence system. So the combination of those sort of non-traditional mechanisms for influence, they could sort of eventually talk Americans into, you know, why bother with it? And they'll support those elements in our society that will eventually, that will sort of be unwilling, therefore, when the time comes to step up. And that's a real danger. And I think that's why we need to think more than about credibility on the presidential level. We need to think about hardening our country as a whole, passing laws to sort of deal with espionage and political influence, thinking harder about cyber. Like, and it's really hard because it's about private companies mostly, right? And then also the space thing, which is also now increasingly a private company phenomenon. And so that's why the China thing has got to be a whole government and a whole society sort of response, and that, again, that's why it takes a lot of work to think in this way, to shift our gears when we're focused on military conflicts elsewhere.
So I think Julian's right on political influence. I think that Vladimir Putin is investing more and has more hopes that we will divide among ourselves and beat each other up. And
looks like he's right.
That's what I'm saying. He has more hope in the long term that the West, in particular the United States, will turn on itself, and that will be the key to his victory, more so than the arms and everything else that he's putting forth in Ukraine. On your cyber question, I think I'm going to look to Jamil here in a second. My impression is that the United States is still trying to work its way through. It, obviously, every cyber attack is not an attack on the United States in the sense of, you know, so we're gonna hit you back with
armed
everything
conflict.
We have, armed conflict. I hear sometimes people say it needs to have sort of physical, tangible effects. What's the state of the debate on this, Jamil? You know cyber better.
You know, it's crazy because I think the state of the debate is what it's been since 2007 and 2011 when we work on these issues, which is to say we're still not sure where the line is in cyber. And the problem, which is to say, what do you have to do to us to make us hit you back in the teeth, right? That line has moved over time, right, under General Nakasone at NSA. We were defending forward and persistently engaging the enemy in their adversary systems, which was more of a forward-leaning position. Congress has provided more authority to the United States to push back affirmatively on China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea if they hit us in the cyber domain. That authority exists today as of 2018. But how it's being used and effectuated is a different story, and how it's perceived by our adversaries is a different story, right? Part of the problem is that for the better part of now going on almost 2 decades, right, maybe a decade and a half, our position has been, we'll know when we see it. When you've hit us hard enough, you'll know we'll know because we'll hit you back. Until then, maybe we'll push back here, maybe we'll push back there, maybe you'll hit us, but we won't make it public, so you'll know something happened, but you won't. The rest of the world won't know. And the problem with that approach to deterrence is it just encourages, like our position on Taiwan and strategic ambiguity, it encourages the adversary to test our boundaries. And we've seen the adversary in the cyber domain test our boundaries, right? China's stolen over $1 trillion of American intellectual property, over a billion dollars a year, time and time again. The Russian proxies took out Colonial Pipeline through a ransomware attack, right? If you believe, by the way, that any ransomware attack happens without the tacit acknowledgement of the Russian regime, Putin and his cronies, you're smoking dope, right? The reality is they are on the take, and they win every time a ransomware attack succeeds against an American company and an American industry. And when they're testing our boundaries on Colonial Pipeline and the like, that is the Russian state operating through proxies. And frankly, those proxies, these Russian criminal gangs, these Eastern European criminal gangs, are simply Russian state actors on their own dime after hours, sometimes effectuating the Russian state interest, sometimes effectuating their own, and sometimes doing both. And so the real challenge here is that we're actually increasing risk by not having a clear policy in the cyber domain about where our line is. And the problem with deterrence, though, too, is if you set a red line, whether that red line is Syria and chemical weapons or in the cyber domain, you have to be willing to enforce it, and you have to be willing to be seen, not just by that adversary, but by all adversaries as enforcing it. And every time you don't set a red line or set a red line and don't enforce it, you undermine your credibility. And the problem is, under 3 presidents in a row, starting with President Obama, then President Trump, and Joe Biden, nobody believes we'll set a red line. Nobody believes we'll enforce a red line. And we do enforce a red line. We'll enforce it in such a way that it'll be a pinprick, so no one will actually care. That is not a policy for winning. That is not a policy for deterrence. It's not that deterrence doesn't work in the cyber domain or in the world writ large. It's that we don't practice deterrence. And I'll end on one point about this, which is to say, we always tell our kids, when you get bullied by a kid on the playground, don't fight the kid. Go tell your teacher, and we, the parents, will hand it behind closed doors, and it'll all be good. The reality is, the better advice to give your kids is, when that bully bullies you, is punch him in the face in front of everybody, because then he'll stop bullying you, and nobody else will come after you again. That is true for your kids, yeah. And it's even more true in the international system. We just have forgotten that we're a superpower.
Yeah, but in our school system, your kid gets expelled. And I mean, it's connected to the broader topic of deterrence, and I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, there's deterrence by punishment, there's deterrence by denial. The United States spends a lot of time on deterrence by denial. We should. It's an important thing to do, but it's defensive, right? Israel spends a lot of time on deterrence by punishment. I mean, it's basically, you kill Israeli, we'll kill 10 Islamic Revolutionary Guard commanders. And on in the cyber domain, Unit 8200, which is their NSA, has been incredibly forward-leaning in terms of offensive cyber, as you probably know. I think there's some lessons to be learned from the Israelis, that you need deterrence by punishment. Yes, you need to set red lines, you need to enforce those red lines, and you need to punch bullies in the face in the cyber domain and in other domains. But if you're not willing to actually be forward-leaning in the use of national power, then you're playing a defensive game through denial. And that's a losing game. It's a very difficult game. And the enemy only has to penetrate your defenses once, and you end up with, to use the analogy, a bloody nose.
our senior leadership doesn't understand it, or to the extent they do, the political leadership doesn't and hasn't for a decade and a half. And until our political leadership, until we decide to elect American presidents who actually want to lead this country instead of following where the people want to be, right, we're not going to succeed. Every time the president, any president, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, takes a poll to figure out what the right foreign policy is, we're failing. The American people actually want America to be strong and lead. We just haven't had a president who's convinced us of that need in the last 15 years. Sir, over here, and then I know there's a question back here, so right here in the middle.
Thank you. I'm wondering if any of the gentlemen on the panel today, and thank you for all your remarks, they've been very enlightening, have any thoughts as to whether or not you believe, and you believe that Russia leaders, Iranian leaders, China's leaders, does anyone believe it is possible to engage in a limited nuclear exchange without that exchange escalating into a complete world war that largely destroys the civilized world? Do you believe it possible to engage in such an exchange? Again, do you think the leaders of other countries believe that is possible? And let's say looking forward through a very fractured crystal ball, what is the likelihood that such exchange might occur in one of these hot places around the world?
This is a great question.
Putin's already threatened it, right? Yeah. He's threatened to introduce tactical nukes into Ukraine, which is part of the reason why the Biden administration has backed down, essentially. I mean, they slow walked the introduction of or the delivery of weapon systems to the Ukrainians. They're not letting the Ukrainians hit the Russians in Russian territory on the border, which allows the Russians to build up their supply lines and amass massive troop formations to strike into Ukraine. So it worked. And the supreme leader of Iran is moving in exactly the same direction. I mean, he wants the next October 7th to be under an Iranian nuclear umbrella, because even if he doesn't introduce tactical nukes into the battle space, he knows a U.S. president will tell the Israelis to stand down. Like, the next time you get attacked, whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah or the IRGC directly, and the Iranians are threatening nuclear escalation, every U.S. president will tell the Israelis to back down, which will severely limit the operational freedom of the IDF. And by the way, we talked about South Korea. I mean, South Korea is a wonderful place. I totally agree with you. Go visit. But we've lost. We've lost because the North Koreans have not only threatened nuclear escalation, they've threatened conventional escalation that could destroy Seoul in a few weeks.
Burning sea of fire.
Right, a burning sea of fire, which means not only do the South Korean military have no conventional military option, we, the United States, don't either, or we think we don't either. We've certainly talked ourselves into that. So you can see how our enemies use the threat of nuclear escalation as a significant deterrent, both in terms of punishment and denial, that ends up translating here in America and in the West as, boy, we don't know how serious they are, so we better not escalate even conventionally. So I think it's been a great tactic by our enemies. I'll let these two gentlemen answer the question of whether we could or should use our own nuclear escalatory threat as a deterrent against them.
Michael?
Well, there's a lot of doctrine out there on these types of questions. I think it's unlikely in the Russia case that we could manage it. To remain limited. It's conceivable. China, I think it's even less likely it's manageable. But by the way, I don't believe, like, the Biden administration congratulates itself all the time on, oh, wow, we're preventing World War III. We are de-escalating all these conflicts. And, you know, at some level, that sounds appealing. We don't want to escalate all these conflicts into full-scale war. But they have worried too much and let Putin set the terms of the debate when Putin should be worrying about our red lines instead of us worrying about his red lines, because what it's done is led to, and you've heard this term, I hope, self-deterrence. We've talked ourselves out of sending first HIMARS, then tanks, then F-16s, now ATACMS. Now we won't let the Ukrainians hit the Russians in their own territory, even if they're massing to attack Ukraine.
Sounds like Rafa, by the way.
And there's examples of this all across the the conflict in Israel right now. Biden is too obsessed with de-escalation and has led to bad policy outcomes which have suited our enemies, particularly Russia, which honestly thrives in this sort of attritional conflict that we have today. Ukraine could have finished the job a long time ago if we'd given them every weapon system they needed.
Exactly. So, Julian, you get the last word. And I know there's a question back here, so we're going to run out of time, but we'll come and get your question offline. So
the only thing I'll add is that historically, China has been very careful not to do anything with it. It has a nuclear, very small nuclear force purely for defense.
And they're tripling it.
Right. So historically, it was defensive. They actually tried to get the U.S. to commit to a no-first-use agreement. We never did. So we actually maintained a pretty good posture, I think, a pretty forward posture with China. What's changed and disturbing is that recent years, very recently, China's announced it's dramatically expanding its nuclear force, and there's a lot of debate over why, but the bottom line is that they, I think, maybe because of these other developments, now think nuclear escalation dominance might have some benefits for China's interests as well, which is...
Because they've seen us cave.
Just to make things worse for the situation that's already pretty bad. So thanks.
All right.
Can I just say one other quick thing, Jamil? One quick thing.
Yeah.
The difference, the Chinese and the Russians are avaricious atheists who want to exist in this world, and the Islamic Republic are Islamist revolutionaries who are looking forward to the next world. And so when you really talk about nuclear escalation, I worry less about the Chinese and Russians than I do about the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guards, who I think believe, actually, at the end of the day, that using nuclear weapons to destroy Israel is not only a smart thing to do, but it's a theologically obligatory thing to do.
Interesting. All right, with that, thank you to the panel.